Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Assad, one of the co-hosts of the channel and your host for our conversation today. Our guest today is Afshin Mateen Asghari, and we'll be talking about his latest book, Both Eastern and Western, An Intellectual History of Iranian Modernity. Dr. Afshin Mateen Asghari holds the title of Outstanding Professor of Middle East History at California State University in Los Angeles. He was born in Iran and completed his PhD in Middle East History at the University of California in Los Angeles. As a young student in Iran, he was active in the international movement of Iranian students during the 1970s and took part in the 1978-1979 Iranian Revolution. He is the author of Iranian Student Opposition to the Shah, which has been translated into Persian, and he has authored more than 20 articles and book chapters on 20th century Iranian political and intellectual history. His latest work, which is the subject of our discussion today, is entitled Both Eastern and Western, An Intellectual History of Iranian Modernity, published by Cambridge University Press in 2018. It is a provocative and timely intervention in Iranian studies and modern Iranian intellectual history. Professor Afshin Mateen Asghari deftly challenges the conventional binaries that characterize both scholarly and public discourse on Iran's historical trajectory leading up to the revolution as a conflict between, quote-unquote, the religious versus the secular, or the traditional versus the modern, or as the title states, the Eastern versus the Western. Mateen Asghari traces the construction of Iranian modernity in the 20th century by framing it as a complement to ongoing projects in global history. In doing so, he argues that Iranian modernity cannot be seen in isolation to global trends and concludes that the history of modern Iran is both Eastern and Western. So without further ado, I welcome Dr. Afshin Mateen Asghari to our podcast. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your program.
Thank you for joining us today. So, Professor, you've just published this phenomenal work in intellectual history with your endnotes alone spanning a staggering 85 pages covering the literature on the subject. And you take us on quite a journey throughout the book. Here at the New Books Network, we have a tradition to always begin our interviews with a historical background and intellectual history of our interviewees. So would you be able to take us on a little bit of your personal journey? I mean, you were active in Iran's student movements and you were present in the country during the revolution. So I'm quite sure that you have a story to tell. So what is it that brought you up until this point and what led to this book and made you into the academic that you are today?
I was born in Iran and grew up there and stayed in the country until I was 19, finished high school there. And already, by the time I finished high school, it was the mid-1970s. And I was somewhat politicized because even the high school milieu, at least in Tehran, was rather political. So when I left Iran as a high school graduate, I was somehow, I'd left these ideas. Also had family members who were political and that had influenced me. And so once I came to the U.S. in 1974, I started going to meetings of Iranian students who were active against the Shah's government. I was never a very kind of active activist. I mean, I did go to protests and demonstrations, but I gravitated towards the fringes of this movement, people who kind of identified as intellectual leftists, and they were critical thinkers. They did not identify with any particular faction or grouping, but they're more interested in some kind of critical understanding of leftist issues. And so that was my affiliation with this movement. That was 2 or 3 years before the revolution. And then the revolution surprisingly happened. And so I went back to join and take part. And that was in December 1978. So I spent less than a year in Iran, the fall of the Shah, the formation of the new Islamic Republic. And again, I did not join any particular movement or organization or party, but I was pretty much active. I wrote journal articles, took part in all kinds of street events. And then I came back to the U.S. just before the U.S. Embassy was taken hostage in Tehran to continue my education and basically stayed in the U.S.
Wow. Incredible. And it eventually led you toward publishing this book.
Well, what happened was I was very quickly disillusioned with the direction the revolution was taking. I was never really uncritically enthusiastic about the leadership. And by the summer of 1979, a few months after the revolution, I had decided that my side, which was kind of like the more democratic left, had lost, and there was no chance. So when I came back to the U.S., it was a question of going back quickly to Iran to join a revolution that I knew was not going where I would have liked to see it go. And then there was the hostage crisis, there was the Iran-Iraq war, and I wasn't necessarily enthusiastic about, joining the war effort. So I ended up in political exile and decided to stay in the academe as sort of a refuge.
Well, your story sounds very much like a number of Iranian intellectuals and thinkers in the Western Academy. It's quite powerful. So let's work through this book now, because you do a lot of things here. First, let's start with chapter one. You begin first here by problematizing the persistent notion of the modern Iranian nation state as a continuation of pre-modern, quote unquote, Iran as an empire. And one of the most one prominent British Orientalist who popularized this notion was Anne C.S. Lanton, whose conception of a Persian government, quote unquote, to describe pre-modern Iran, was itself colored by nationalist conceptions of the nation state. And so here you talk about how the Qajar kingdom was characterized by this Muluka al-Tawaif paradigm, a political structure of smaller coexisting tribes or factions similar to Europe's feudal system of fractured authority. And then following this, you situate the genesis of Iranian modernity with the nation state and its attendant ideology of nationalism. And you go on to talk about how Iranian modernity and its watershed event, i.e. the constitutional revolution, was more intellectually and politically similar to the Russo-Ottoman model than a Western one. So can you tell us a little bit about how the Iranian state, the early Iranian state, and its modernizing intellectuals interacted with this quote-unquote Russo-Ottoman model? And what were those processes and what forms did they take?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. The argument you mentioned about discontinuity between modern Iran as a nation state and pre-modern Iran as something definitely other than a nation state, political entity, perhaps a failed empire, That was one of the main points that I think is still not addressed enough in the historiography of Iran. There's still attachment to this continuity model of Iran as if Iran as a nation existed, if not in perpetuity, at least for 1,000 years or 2,000 years. So my argument was, no, we have to make a categorical distinction between Iran as a nation state and pre-modern Iran, whatever it was. Now, the question of Russo-Ottoman model was, again, I think something that I emphasized for the first time. I have not seen it argued by people who write in Iranian historiography. Usually the argument, there are several intellectual histories of modern Iran, and usually it's a question of Iran's interaction with an entity called the West, which is itself never clearly defined. It's not clear whether by the West they mean Western Europe or a particular European model, whether it's English parliamentarism or French, or the notion of the West remains unclear. But my argument was, whatever the West means, Iran, when it's modern, the project of thinking about modernity, or which I identify with the modern nation state, when that project begins, there's no direct interaction with the West per se, but there's a very clear and consistent interaction with Iran's neighbors, and these two, the most influential neighboring influences, are those from Tsarist Russia and then the Ottoman Empire. And both of these have modernization projects that are quite similar to, in some ways, to each other, and they are similar to modernization of the Qajar era, continuing into the 20th century. And also intellectually, I would argue the influences coming from the Russian Empire and from the Ottoman Empire are paramount in shaping the origins of Iranian modernity.
Interesting. And so would you say now that going on into your next chapter, that there was somewhat of a Western, quote-unquote Western influence, but much, much later on, specifically coming out of Germany?
I have a chapter called The Berlin Circle, and that's the story of a number of nationalists, the most influential of the first generation of Iranian nationalist thinkers, gathering in Berlin during World War I. Because during that war, something important has happened already. The Constitutional Revolution, the so-called birth event of the modern Iranian nation state, has occurred in early 20th century. So Iran has a constitution. And I have an argument that Iranian constitutionalism, more than anything else, must be understood in terms of a conscious patterning after Ottoman constitutionalism. Because the young Ottomans in 19th century had very carefully and systematically adapted constitutionalism to Islam. And that was done a generation before Iranian constitutionalism, and Iranian constitutionalist thinkers were very much aware of the Ottoman model, and I would say consciously followed it. So Iran had a constitution, but it was basically on paper before it could be implemented and become something institutionalized and meaningful. And Iran was occupied from the north by Russian forces and from the south by the British. And so the constitutional project was up in the air, suspended. But a group of Iranian intellectuals who were actually exiles during the war, they gathered in Berlin, because Germany was the enemy of their enemy. Russia and the British Empire had occupied Iran. Germany was their enemy. So naturally, these people gravitated to Germany, and the German Reich was promoting this kind of intellectual opposition to its rivals, and so provided them with support even financially, and it began publishing journals and periodicals trying to articulate, I would say, a kind of a not just a conception, the first conception of Iranian nationalism coherently conceived, but also they tried to anchor that within a worldview. They had to find a place for themselves and for Iran as a hopefully modern independent nation state, somewhere in a world that was itself turned upside down by in the middle of the war. It wasn't clear what the outcome of the war would be, and Germany might have very well won the war in 1916, 1917. It appeared that way. And so they aligned themselves with Germany. And that's the Berlin Circle of Iranian intellectuals.
It's interesting, this intervention, because here you show that the conceptions of enlightened despotism and authoritarian nationalism began to take root among Iranian intelligentsia, not through supposedly perennial or innate patterns of quote-unquote Iranian despotism, but through the influence of the German political culture of 1920s Berlin. And as a corollary to this argument, you also demonstrate that, you know, there was nothing inevitable about the authoritarian nationalism which emerged in the 20s and 30s. And I think this is something key here, because oftentimes we hear in the historiography and even in public discourse that the authoritarian nationalism was something that, you know, was an inevitable consequence of that time period.
Yes, no, that's an important point. There's an Orientalist conception of this perennial Asiatic or Oriental or Islamic despotism. You mentioned Lambton is one of the very influential Orientalists who has argued this. And I'm not arguing that Iran was ripe for, you know, democracy or anything like that. But I'm saying, as you pointed out, that in the middle of World War One, you have a rather fluid situation where the articulation of Iranian nationalism can take different directions. And the outcome of this war and the events that happened during this war are very crucial in giving shape and direction to Iranian nationalist ideology and nation building project. And the authoritarian nationalism that you see emerging under Reza Shah in the 1920s is the outcome of this process that is not predetermined. Perhaps more authoritarian tendencies had a kind of a stronger chance anyway, but there were other countervailing tendencies which were forcibly removed. The fact that they were forcibly removed means that there was no kind of inherent inevitable outcome that had to be authoritarian. The authoritarianism won out.
I'm jumping a little bit here, but this can perhaps also be said about the 1978 to 1979 revolution. That was it. Even then, we can say that it was not a necessary outcome that Khomeini and his camp would win over. It was what had happened due to the historical contingency. I would be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes, we can. My book doesn't really go into the period after the revolution, but I agree with you that, again, the outcome of the 1978-79 revolution was not given. And the reason that's obvious is there was a very intense power struggle after the revolution over its outcome. And events such as the hostage crisis that put the U.S. into an enemy camp of the Iranian Revolution, which was not where the U.S. was in the beginning. The U.S. early on was not opposed to the formation of the Islamic Republic, but it was the hostage crisis that turned everything around. And then the war with Iraq, they gave a context and a direction that made the outcome of the revolution very different.
So now, going back now to the 40s and the 50s, in one of your chapters, you identify quite a few prominent figures. I'll just go down the list and name them and some of their contributions, and maybe we can sort of unpack them and the ideas that they promulgated during this time. One of the more prominent thinkers you identify is Ahmad Kasravi, who was critical of Europe and quote-unquote Europeanism, as well as clericalism, the latter for which he was eventually assassinated. There was also a young Khomeini who published his first polemical work, Kashf al-Asrar, in defense of Shi'i Islam against the criticism of secular intellectuals like Khasravi. You also name Fakhreddin Shadman, who wrote The Conquest of European Civilization, which in a way reduced Iran's dilemma to a cultural one and argued for the assimilation of modern European culture into Iran via a translation project of European cultural forms into Persian. And then the fourth intellectual you identify is Jalal al-Ahmad, who I'd like to speak about a little bit more, who wrote the infamous Garb Zadegi, or West Struckness, which critiqued Shadman, but also Iranian society as a whole, for too readily abandoning their quote-unquote cultural authenticity. So can you, for our listeners who may be not so familiar with the trends taking place in Iranian history and historiography, can you give us a picture of what the intellectual debates looked like between these figures and their interlocutors in the 40s and the 50s?
Sure. I tried to make this fairly intelligible in a few sentences. The generation you mentioned, the generation of 1940s and 1950s, I refer to as the missing link in the intellectual genesis of this quote-unquote anti-Western or authenticity discourse that is articulated very strongly in the 1960s and 1970s and is obviously some kind of an intellectual background to the revolution. So in my discussion of 1940s, 1950s intellectuals like Ahmad Khasravi, Jan Khomeini, and Shadman, I'm trying to show that there was a precedence to discourse of al-Ahmad and others in the 1960s and 1970s, or Shariati for that matter. Khasravi and Shadman were different. Khasravi especially was perhaps the most important figure in that era, because as I try to show, he's very important in articulating a very influential critique of what he called Europeanism. And that is a kind of a wholesale imitation of European ways, what is later going to be called kind of Westernization. He calls it Europeanism. He's also very critical of clericalism. He's an Islamic reformist at first, but tries to purge and purify Islam from superstition and what he calls clerical despotism. But then he carries this critique farther into beyond clericalism, into rejecting Shi'ism itself as a kind of superstition. And eventually he carries it beyond Islam and he comes up with his own idea of a new kind of a deistic religion of, he calls it religion of purity. And for his radicalism, he's assassinated by Muslim terrorists. Now, the connection to al-Ahmad is a bit more complicated. If you want me to talk a bit more about al-Ahmad, his Garb Zadegi, I try to argue, is not his most important work, although unfortunately it's his most influential work.
Can you share a little bit more about that?
Garb Zadegi is a small pamphlet that he wrote almost in a rush in the early 1960s. And I do admit that it was highly influential because perhaps it kind of captured the feeling of the moment. He had his hand on the pulse, intellectual pulse of the moment. And the arguments in Garb Zadegi are rather incoherent and contradictory. And even al-Ahmad himself later on more or less admits to it. It's a work that is more or less in line with trends that were coming together across the world, critique of the West, kind of anti-imperialism against neo-colonialism, the idea that culture, an authentic national culture, was important in resistance to colonialism, ideas of the Third World. So al-Ahmad is more or less in line with these trends. He read French and he was, you know, aware of intellectual scene of the 1950s, 1960s. He came from a socialist or Marxist background. But here in Garb Zadegi, he argues that a form of resistance to anti-colonialism would be some holding on to national culture.
And how did he define this national culture? Or was it this sort of floating signifier for him?
In Nabzadegi, it's not very clear. And he talks about religion, he talks about Islam, as also as a connection that intellectuals can make with ordinary Iranians, with the masses, who he argues are religious. But he never really is clear, in Nabzadegi at least, what this might mean. Now, I have an argument in my book that if one really wants to understand Al Ahmad more fairly, we have to read his last book, which he published after Nabzadegi. It's a substantial work, 300-400 pages. And in it, he lays out his ideas more clearly, more coherently, and is not exactly arguing as he does in Nabzadegi. It's a work on intellectuals and Iranian intellectuals. I think that is the proper legacy of Al Ahmad, that thinks him a more careful and thoughtful thinker rather than Nabzadegi, which is a sloppy work.
Now, what distinguished Al Ahmad from Shariati in terms of the message of their discourses? We do know that Shariati came a little bit later. But what was the distinction between the messages that they both imparted?
Well, Ahmad was a former communist, at least in a phase in his life. He was a member of the Tudeh Party. And when he wrote Nabzadegi, and he died in the 1960s, 1969, I believe. By that time, he was not exactly a Marxist, but he was definitely a socialist. And he was also interested in this cultural resistance to anti-colonialism and imperialism, which were the projects of Nabzadegi and his last work. Shariati was younger, and he too was formed by, this is an argument that I make about Shariati in my book. I want to emphasize Shariati's background and intellectual formation and his association with this movement of God-worshipping socialists, which was, again, an important but really not very much studied or understood movement of 1950s Iran, in reaction very much to the influence of Iran's communists to their party. And God-worshipping socialists, as the title of their organization suggested, were a socialist organization. They just argued that they also believed in God. Although, as you see in the name of their organization, they called themselves God-worshipping socialists, not Muslim socialists. So the idea of religion was something more nebulous. It was some kind of a deist concept of they believed in God and they were not materialist, and yet they were socialists. And Shariati was a young Shariati and his father. They were both members of this organization. And my argument is, to understand Shariati, we have to go back and look at the ideas of God-worshipping socialists. Shariati then expanded these ideas, but his first major work is called Abu Zar, the God-worshipping socialist. And I think in many ways, Shariati remained within the paradigm established by God-worshipping socialists. Although I understand that, you know, his period of studying in France exposed him to new ideas, I would say he clarified and expanded those ideas. But in essence, I would say his ideas were formed even before he left Iran in the 1960s.
This is a great transition into my next question. I'd like to talk a little bit about what you call, quote, the mid-century moment of socialist hegemony, end quote. You write that among the least studied ideological trends in pre-revolutionary Iran is Islamic socialism, which was another reaction to the Tudeh Party's far-reaching influence. Now, the Tudeh Party, as we know, was easily one of the largest, if not the largest, leftist parties in the Middle East at the time. And I think that point you make about its prominence resulting in the emergence of competing movements that offered similar and overlapping programs is crucial, because we often see in the historiography a framework that, quote, Muslims and Marxists were always these two separate discrete and distinct camps. And if I'm not mistaken, you argue that the picture is a little bit more complex. So I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about the obscure genealogy of Islamic socialism in the historiography and what case you make for the Islamic socialists.
Exactly. Precisely as you said, I emphasize that mid-century moment of socialist hegemony. And in that, Iran is not alone. That is the moment of the birth of the Third World. And you look at every single one of these third world countries, especially the leaders, Egypt under Nasser has some kind of Egyptian socialism, Sukarno, Indonesia, somewhat leaning towards an idea of at least mixing socialism with Indonesian nationalism, same thing in India. So Iran was no exception. And Iran had a very strong communist party because, as I argue in that chapter, it's not so much that the communists were super kind of powerful intellectually. It was that you had an empty scene. There was no one else to compete with them. So they completely and totally occupied the political and intellectual scene. So therefore, all other influential movements inevitably had to either define themselves in reaction to socialism and Marxism, or somehow overlap and interact with it. And from the other side, even the Tudeh party at first tried to blur the distinction between Marxism and religion, and even claimed that the religion of the Tudeh party was Islam. That was kind of a deliberate lie. It was a tactical move. But there was an attempt from the other side to blur distinctions. And therefore, you have something like the God-worshipping socialist, which is, you read their literature, it's a typical third worldist socialist movement. At the same time, it argues, and I think sincerely, that they have some kind of metaphysical belief in God. They don't believe the clerical kind of idea of Iranian Shiism. They don't deny or reject it, but they basically ignore it. And I think this God-worshipping socialist is one of those, you know, ignored missing links. Shariati, arguably the most influential Muslim intellectual of pre-revolutionary Iran, comes from that background and is not alone. I mean, at that time, you see that thinkers like Ayatollah Taleghani writes a very influential tafsir, interpretation, commentary on the Quran with socialist leanings. And you can see also in the discourse of Khomeini himself in the 1970s, especially, traces of socialist influences. It begins to talk about the downtrodden and the mustazafin and capitalist exploitation and imperialist, things that were totally and completely absent from his discourse in the 1940s when he wrote Kashf al-Asrar.
It seems that the influence of socialism and the Tudeh party was so strong that it even compelled the Shah to implement reforms along socialist lines with his white revolution. Could you talk a little bit about that as well?
Exactly, precisely. That's a very important issue. And the Shah at times even claimed to be some kind of socialist. But the most important project of his entire period of rule was the first, it was called the White Revolution, then it was called, the name was changed to the Shah People Revolution. The very fact that it was called a revolution shows the influence of revolutionary leftist ideas. And the major points of the White Revolution, which was a social reform project, incomplete, conservative, nevertheless real, the most important point was land reform, which no other political party except Iranian leftists, going back to the time of the Constitutional Revolution, it was the project or the proposal of Social Democrats. And then in mid-century, the party that consistently advocated land reform was the Tudeh Communist Party. And another point was women's rights, giving women the right to vote. That was, again, the party that advocated that very persistently was the Tudeh party. nationalization of natural resources was also a leftist agenda, and the Shah very consciously took that up and made it his own, and sort of made it an ongoing revolution, like Trotsky's permanent revolution, a revolution that would never end, added to it different kind of welfare projects. And so I attribute that to, again, the continuing hegemony of leftist ideas and leftist discourse. Even though the left itself was defeated and driven underground, its ideas were still hegemonic. So the Shah, in a sense, capitulated to them or picked them up.
It seems like both the Shah and the Islamists reappropriated and repackaged these leftist discourses. And it appears to be especially prominent in the 60s and the 70s. So let's move on to that period. Here, you identify three major discursive formations. And you say that the first two were counter-modernist and politically right-wing, categorically rejecting Western modernity along with democracy, liberalism, and Marxism. But the third, which I think follows from the points you made earlier, was a leftist or Marxist-inflected reading of Shiism, which had a crucial role in the ideological preparation for the 1978-1979 revolution. Could you talk a little bit about these three discursive formations and the contestation between them, with regards to Iranian modernity leading up to the revolution?
Well, one of the things in the background of these discursive formations is, in that chapter, I also argue that the Shah's regime, in some ways, again, capitulated to the discourse of authenticity and the anti-Western discourse, and it picked up a form of that discourse itself. Because these ideas were so strong and so influential. But as you pointed out, my argument is that there were different articulations of the critique of the West, or a return to some kind of Iranian authenticity. Some of them could be right-wing or conservative and secular. Others could be religious, Islamic, and right-wing. Some could be kind of clerically inflected, others not so much. But I think the most important or the most influential of all of them, even though there was some overlap between all three, the most influential, because you see its significance during the revolution, was the leftist inflected Islamist discourse, most prominently recognized in Shariati, but there was also Iran's Mujahideen Khalq, the leftist guerrilla movement, whose ideas in many ways overlapped with Shariati, except that they advocated armed struggle. Shariati at some point was drawn closer to them, but then I think towards the end of his life, he went back on that and was taking a new direction. Of course, he died young, and it's not clear where he might have ended up had he stayed alive. If he had lived a natural life, he would have been alive during the revolution, and it's not clear what position he would have taken. But his ideas were clearly on the side of the Islamic left, which I argue was the most influential of these discourses that were very critical of Western models. And yet, if you look at Shariati, you see a lot of ambivalences. It's not exactly clear if he is rejecting these quote-unquote European ideas. One of them would be Marxism. He is very critical of Marxism, and yet at the same time, he admits that he's also influenced by it.
Right, it's one of those contested conversations that we'll never have the ability to find out, and it will continually be debated. And I guess that's what really makes this field and this particular subject so interesting. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, Professor. And so we have a tradition here now of concluding with a teaser for our listeners. So I wanted to ask you now, are there any projects that you are currently working on that we can look forward to seeing in the future?
Well, I wanted to thank you again for giving me this opportunity to talk with you and have your listeners listen to a discussion of my book. New projects, I'm kind of continuing to work on intellectual history, hopefully now kind of looking at the scene after the revolution, which I didn't get to in this book. But I'm also putting together a collection of my previously published articles and book chapters with a thematic focus on the Iranian left. So hopefully that work will come out within the next year or so.
Well, sounds wonderful. I look forward to reading it. There you have it, listeners. It is, again, both Eastern and Western, an intellectual history of Iranian modernity by Professor Afshin Mateen Askari. Get your hands on it as soon as you can. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.